from the nicely mulched studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another potato picking hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Would you like to grow your own potatoes but don't want to do a lot of digging? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll reveal how to grow super spuds above ground. Plus, are pine straw and salt hay the perfect garden mulches? And of course, your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and factually fomented fermentations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like you picking potatoes with no shovel in sight.
WDIY has been broadcasting in the Lehigh Valley and beyond for 30 years, providing news.
These planes were hijacked.
The Bethlehem Steel Corporation will end its steelmaking production in Bethlehem.
We hope that you enjoyed hearing from the Dalai Lama.
Local public affairs.
As I say, it's a race of interest.
What we're experiencing today will later on be studied.
And music.
My name is Janice Ian.
Our guest, Lake Street Dive.
In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Petey Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
WDIY, since 1995.
From the unpolluted studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another easy breathing hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we present a recent article from the Washington Post in which writers Nima Ahmed and Chico Harlan report that the radiance of the City of Light is much brighter now, thanks to tough new regulations. In a story the Post has titled, Paris said au revoir to cars. Air pollution maps reveal a dramatic change. And I quote from the Post, over the past 20 years, Paris has undergone a major physical transformation, trading automotive arteries for bike lanes, adding green spaces, and eliminating 50,000 parking spots. Part of the payoff has been invisible in the air itself. Air Paris, an independent group that tracks air quality for France's capital region, reports that levels of fine particulate matter have decreased 55% since 2005, while nitrogen dioxide levels have fallen 50%. Air pollution heat maps used to illustrate the article show the pollution levels of 20 years ago as being well above European Union limits. In the years since, the red zone, indicated on the accompanying map as a giant, almost solid red blotch over the entire area, had shrunk to only a web of fine lines that are almost all located around the busiest roads and highways in and around the city. Map reading McGrath here. I wish you could see the six time sequence squares used to dramatically illustrate this story. In 2006, you can see that the pollution levels dominate the map. There's a little improvement by 2010, but you can still see that pollution levels remain high. By 2020, a dramatic change is clearly visible, and by 2024, there are just a few red lines left. Back to quoting the Post. This change shows how ambitious policymaking can directly improve health in large cities. Air pollution is often described by health experts as the silent killer. Fine particulate matter and nitrogen dioxide have both been linked to major health problems, including heart attacks, lung cancer, bronchitis, and asthma. And the improvement is credited to Anne Hidalgo, mayor of Paris since 2014, a socialist who has pushed for many green policies and has described her wish for a Paris that breathes, a Paris that is more agreeable to live in. Her proposals have faced pushback from right-leaning politicians, a car owners association, and suburban commuters who say that targeting cars makes their lives difficult. But last month, Parisians voted for a referendum to turn an additional 500 streets over to pedestrians. A year earlier, Paris had moved to sharply increase parking fees for SUVs. The city has also turned a bank of the Seine from a busy artery into a pedestrian zone and banned most car traffic from the shopping boulevard of Rue de Rivoli. For a final comment, the Post turned to Carlos Moreno, a professor at Paris's Sorbonne University and a former advisor to the city, who notes that, quote, Paris has merely developed an urban policy based on well-being. Now, isn't that a nice thing to do?
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. In just a little bit, we'll teach you how to grow potatoes without digging of any kind and how to grow potatoes even if you don't have any ground to plant them in. It's amazing, and it'll be coming up right after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls. Our phone number, 610-694-8100. You can listen to the prompts or just dial extension number 3. All roads lead to us. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thanks very much, Mike.
Well, thank you, Bill. How you doing?
Pretty good. Spending some time over here in Yardley, PA.
Ah, you've answered my question already. So you're in a suburb of Philadelphia.
Yes.
All right. What can we do you for?
Well, I have a bunch of raised beds, but I had a question about succession planting. Things like tomatoes, you don't plant until much later. And I start up peas and things like that real early. Likewise, you know, later for stuff in the fall, can I plant more than one thing in a particular area?
Oh, yes, especially in the fall. I have found spring to be a little tricky. Let's use your example of peas followed by tomatoes. No matter how early you start peas, you're really not going to get any until around the 1st of June. You can't put them in frozen ground, even if they're pre-sprouted. And it takes about 60 days for most types of peas to mature to the point where you can begin harvesting the first pods. But then you've got all of June. That's why they call them June peas sometimes, to harvest. But it's a short window. And by July, who knows? You know, I generally plan to be done with my peas on the 1st of July. And the way you tell is if the heat has built up enough that the vines are obviously suffering. they're not going to last much longer. The peas are not going to taste anywhere near as good because they need cold weather to sweeten up their legendary sugars. And in my case, what I do, because I inoculate my peas, you buy a specific bacteria in powder form and you dust it into the planting hole as you put your peas in. And that bacteria has a symbiotic relationship with the seeds that allows the growing plants to take nitrogen directly from the air. And of course, our air is mostly nitrogen. So you kind of get free fertilizer. So what I do is generally July 1st, July 4th, I'm pulling up my peas. I learned long ago, don't give up 2 weeks for five bad tasting peas. And I immediately plant my beans in the same holes. Pea and bean inoculant is a general term. It provides the bacteria that both plants can use to take that nitrogen from the air. And when you use the powder, it cultivates that bacteria in the soil. So by the time you get to bean planting time, string beans, snap beans, pole beans, all those things, the inoculant should work better because the soil's warm and it's had time to spread out. So I would not follow tomatoes after peas, but beans seems to be a sure thing. Okay. You know, because peas like the cold, but beans like the heat. Some of them, like English shelling peas and pole beans, need a sturdy support. You'd be crazy not to double up on that support. And again, the soil will be primed. You don't need more inoculant. It's going to be there, lively, looking for plant roots to help out until you get a freeze. And you want to plant in the Philadelphia area your tomatoes by June 1st. I know a lot of people say the middle of May. I've seen it snow. I've seen it drop to 20 degrees at night. June 1st is safe because this is a great time to remind people, if you put out your tomatoes too early, hoping to get them early, and there's any kind of cold weather that blows in, you're going to get your harvest 2 to 3 weeks later than the cowards who plant on June 1st. So that's my day. And for that reason, the pea tomato thing doesn't work. But I would see a lot of benefit in planting fast-growing salad greens that don't need to head up. The leafy greens, the ones that go into those million-dollar plastic pounds of baby greens in the supermarket, because they can be harvested after a few weeks, especially if you pre-sprout the seeds inside, or even better, start the baby plants as if they were tomatoes and stuff, knowing that you can move them outside when it's still chilly, because they like cold weather. And by the time June comes around, you will have harvested quite a lot of lettuce, but that lettuce is not going to turn bitter and be useless for another month. But now, maybe you harvest all the lettuces in the center of this raised bed, put in a tomato plant, and let the lettuce leaves continue until, and you'll know it right away, until they burn up in the summer heat. And right. like peas, lettuce can't taste good once the weather gets too hot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it sounds like you can, you know, in many cases get two things during a season, but probably not three.
Well, it depends. Now you're into season extension devices and praying for a mild winter. My good friend Elliot Coleman, the master of all master gardeners, he has what's called his four-season farm on the chilly coast of Maine. And he has learned how to produce edible crops 12 months of the year in what would seem impossible conditions. But he has greenhouses that roll on railroad tracks and crazy stuff, insulating with hay bales, piling up horse and poultry manure in the center of the greenhouse to keep it warm. But at the end of the season, you have total planting options. You know, we all want those last four tomatoes to ripen up. They're not worth the space they're taking up. You know,
right.
Bring them inside. If there's lots of green tomatoes, hang them upside down in your garage or pull off the tomatoes and put them single level in boxes. And then you can sow lettuce seed and other fall greens directly into the soil because it's wonderfully warm. And they're going to sprout up fast. But as the days get shorter, the weather is going to become very quickly the type of weather they love. And you're always going to get better tasting salad greens in the fall because they're not heading towards heat oblivion.
Good. Well, I'll have to try all that out.
Yeah, it's a start. And there are many schemes online that you can look at. Just make sure it makes sense for your region. One of the things I've always noticed about internet device advice, maybe it's a device too, is that they rarely tell you where they are. And a California gardener giving advice to the United States is worse than useless.
Well, good. Well, I have my plans for putting things together then for 2025.
Yep, as are we all. All right, Bill, thanks for a great question.
Take care.
You too. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind all of you that I will talk about turf and tomatoes and answer your garden questions live on Saturday, May 10th at 1 p.m., at the amazing Nurture Nature Center in Easton, which is just across the street from Easton's Historic State Theater. The event is free, but you must pre-register at eastonchna.org/events. That's CHNA for the College Hill Neighborhood Association. Got it? Bring a shelf-stable food bank donation if you can, but don't go signing up just yet because we'll be right back to discuss using pine straw and salt hay as mulches and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past three decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden. From the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, I am your host, Mike McGrath, coming up later in the show. Do you hate to dig? Can you no longer dig? Have you simply learned that digging is the least fun you can have in gardening? Or perhaps you have little to no in-ground space to dig in? Well, you're going to love this week's question of the week because it's how to build an above-ground potato bin where you can harvest a load of potatoes in a 4-foot square space and not do any digging. You're just putting your hands through fresh soil on the surface. But now it is time to bring on our returning special guest, Bill Strock, the owner and founder of Mid-Atlantic Pine Straw and SaltHay.com, to learn us all about one of the best mulches that can be used in an organic garden or just about anywhere, but I don't want to acknowledge the rest of you out there. So, Bill, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike, for having me back again. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here because, as we have discussed in the past, as you head south, once you get into the Eastern Shore and beyond, you don't see this wood chip mulch anywhere. You see people mulching their plants, their garden beds, their vegetable crops with pine straw, which we should mention is not like the pine needles on a Christmas tree. I know there's so many, you know, you think pine straw, okay, I'll take a bale of pine straw, please. And then you get to say what kind, right?
Yeah, the pine straw is the longleaf pine straw. It's Pinus palustris, and it's the longleaf pine that grows in the southeastern part of the United States.
And very different than the kind of pine needles that we have here in the Mid-Atlantic currently.
That's correct. Longleaf pine needles are averaging anywhere from about 8 to 18 inches in length versus like the white pine that you find locally here in the Mid-Atlantic states. That's a much shorter needle. So the longleaf pine has many benefits because of its longer needle length.
But I have a white pine that I inherited in my front yard, so I know how much material these trees deposit, and it's all throughout the year, right? They're constantly replacing their branches, leaves, whatever you want to call it. So even though the white pine I have in my front yard is only medium size, thanks to the electric company with their annual butchering, it produces needles of a decent size and a lot of them, which is why I know, not just whispering down the lane, I know personally what a great mulch this makes.
Yes, it's an ideal mulch. It's a natural, renewable, sustainable mulch. It contains no weed seeds in it. It's just pure pine needles. So unlike regular hardwood bark mulches, you just don't know what the inputs were to manufacture that product. There could be dyes in that as well. And, you know, you don't want to be putting someone else's yard waste into your mulch beds by using a hardwood bark mulch. So pine needles, you're not putting any weed seeds in, and it's just a natural product.
Right. So it is weed free. And it's my understanding that this material, before it's shipped to the Mid-Atlantic, is checked for insects or possible disease pathogens?
That's correct. So the USDA guidelines state that any nursery stock
shipping out of the southeastern part of the United States has to be inspected for invasive species before it departs. So we work closely with NC State University and Clemson University's invasive species specialists when we have a tractor trailer load that's getting picked up to come north to us in Chester County, Pennsylvania. We have them come in, they inspect, they bait the trailers. It takes about 2 hours once they come back and check the traps, so long as there's no fire ants or invasive species found in the trailers. We are issued a phyto certificate that clears us for shipping of the pine straw up north to us, and we're the only known pine straw company to perform these tests before any of our products deliver to us in Pennsylvania.
And that is so important. There have been campaigns for, I guess it's been a decade now, not to move firewood around because you could move the emerald ash borer and other invasive creatures into a new state. And the only thing you're bringing us is pine straw. And did I read correctly on your website that you are approved for organic gardening and farming by OMRI, the Organic Materials Research Institute?
That's correct, Mike. So last year we sent samples of our product to a third-party independent lab for testing. Then we submit those samples, those test results to OMRI, the Organic Materials Review Institute. And then they analyze that data and come back to us, and they told us that our product can be considered organic inputs. So, yeah, we are the only company that has pine straw that is OMRI listed.
So I know your company has expanded over the years with another similar product called salt hay. But I want to finish up with a pine straw just in the very practical way. How do people get it? What sizes are available to them? Is it shipped in giant bales in different sizes, different volumes?
Yeah, so Mike, our bales are harvested by hand and hand baled in South and North Carolina. We rake up the pine straw, the sandy soil. We put in a metal box baler that has a plunger. Then we keep plunging it to put as much pine straw into the plunger, and then we wrap it with two strings of twine, and then those bales are hand-loaded onto a tractor trailer. We can haul about 1,800 bales on our tractor trailer.
Whoa.
And then those bales each weigh about 14 pounds each. They're 26 by 13 by 13 in length, and then they're delivered up to us in Pennsylvania in Chester County. So we have a pickup location at Maxwell's Hardware in Downingtown, Pennsylvania, where if a customer just wants 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 bales or 20 or 30, they can pick it up there. Or we deliver throughout the entire Mid-Atlantic states, the pine straw. We have customers in actually Manhattan. We have customers in Northern Virginia. So we cover the entire Mid-Atlantic states. We have a van. We have a box truck. We have trailers. And we can deliver typically our minimum size is 20 bales for delivery, and we can deliver. We stack the product at your driveway for you. The bales are easy to install, so pine straw takes about half the time to install versus hardwood bark mulch. No wheelbarrows or pitchforks are required to install the pine straw.
And it's so much easier to move around and get exactly right.
Correct. And three bales is equivalent to 1 yard of mulch. So if
okay.
you're today buying hardwood bark mulch, the equivalent is 3 bales to 1 yard of mulch, and that will make it simple for ordering online.
And people can learn a lot more about their different ways of acquiring this at the website for this product, which is called Mid-Atlantic Pine Straw.
I've got midatlanticpinestraw.com. And then I will also mention we have a location up in Worcester, Massachusetts. So we also own newenglandpinestraw.com. So any of your listeners up in the New England states, they can pick up products at a 800-acre dairy farm just outside of Worcester, Massachusetts.
Huh. All right. Now let's move on to salt hay, which really is nothing like its name, it's an aquatic plant that's harvested from marshy waters, right?
Correct. So salt hay has been around for a long time, but it's only regionally known. It's mostly known in the Delaware Valley, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware areas, because it's harvested only in two places in the United States, New Jersey and Massachusetts. It's harvested in the brackish waters of off the Delaware Bay, and it can only be harvested maybe once or twice a year because the marshes have to freeze and the tides have to be out and the winds have to be right in order for us to get onto the marsh when it's dry and harvest the salt hay. But what's unique about the salt hay is instead of using a traditional wheat straw mulch in your vegetable gardens, salt hay contains no weed seeds. So you're not putting any wheat seeds into your vegetable garden and having your vegetables compete with these other weed seeds that you planted into your bed by using, you know, a traditional wheat straw product. So salt hay is weed seed free, and it's also rot resistant. Since it grows in a marsh, it can be reused over multiple growing seasons.
J.I. Rodale, the founder of Organic Gardening magazine and the man who coined the term organic gardening, always felt that plants that grew in or right near water had special abilities and were worth more in a compost pile or as mulch than land-grown plants, say, so to speak.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was not aware of that information, so thank you for sharing that.
So what's the plant?
Salt hay is Spartina patens. Spartina patens is the technical name for salt hay.
And, you know, I hear the genus, but I'm not recognizing it. What else is in that genus?
I do not know that. So I know it's Spartina patens. There's different versions of that out there. And the version that grows in the version that we purchase and secure is from the New Jersey area.
So how did it get the name salt hay?
That's a good question. I do not know, but it's very interesting because actually salt hay has forage value as well because the USDA, I spoke with them earlier this year, and they actually did a study on salt hay because the ponies at Chincoteague and Assateague were eating the salt hay, and they wanted to understand the nutritional value of the salt hay for the ponies, and it actually has some nutritional value, the salt hay. But it's also 50, 60, 70 years ago, they used salt hay to insulate concrete. Once concrete was poured, they would put the salt hay over the concrete to help cure it. So it just goes to show that it's a great mulch for insulating tender young plants out there.
How do people acquire the salt hay?
Yep, so you can go to salthay.com. You can order boxes there. We offer two types of boxes. One's a 12 by 12 by 12 inch box, and the other box is a bale box. So we'll ship a bale of salt hay to you, and we can ship nationwide salt hay. And you can also purchase, if you're not locally, we can ship pine straw as well. You can order boxes and bales of pine straw as well as salthay.com.
And we want to reassure people there's no salt in salt hay.
Yeah, that's correct. We have asked the USDA with regards to, does it put any salt into your beds when you apply salt hay? And they said no. The salt content is pretty much dried up when the salt hay gets applied to your vegetable garden beds.
And there's no guarantee they're growing in salty water as opposed to a freshwater marsh.
Yeah, it's pretty much a brackish marsh. So it's a combination of freshwater and saltwater because it's grown in the marshes off of the Delaware Bay about midway up from Cape May to Wilmington, Delaware. That's where the marshes are located.
And it's just amazing because, again, J.I. Rodale felt strongly that plants that grow in water have extra nutritional properties. And that makes sense because they're eating natural fish food at their own rate, decomposed fish food that probably makes the bottom of that marsh very luxurious for plants.
A nice thing I'm seeing is people use the pine straw for the walking paths around their raised beds, and then they put the solvay in their beds, and the color contrast is really nice because you have reddish-brown pine straw on the ground walking path, and then you have a blonde solvay in the beds, if you want to say something like that.
Okay. Well, that now we're even color-coded. The information just rolls on. But it is time to say goodbye to our special guest, Bill Strzok, owner and founder of Mid-Atlantic Pine Straw. And there's a dash between Mid and Atlantic. And salthay.com. You can find lots of information about these things at those two websites, midatlanticpinestraw.com and salthay.com. And it is always a pleasure to talk to you. We always learn something, but you know I'm a huge fan of bringing these really good mulches, mulches that improve things instead of harm them, to the public eye. So Omni approved, they're organic, horses love to eat them. Well, not the pine straw, the salt hay. And all's right with the world. Bill, I hope people check out your websites, just if only to learn more about these agricultural items.
Yeah, more and more people are learning that the pine straw and salt hay is available locally, and it's becoming a very popular alternative to traditional hardwood bark mulches because people like that it's natural, it contains no weed seeds, and it's much easier to work with. So thanks again for having me on today, Mike.
Always a pleasure to promote this fabulous mulch. All right, Bill, we'll talk to you again next year, I guess.
Sounds great. Thank you, Mike.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone that this is the crucial time for you to make sure that your spring bulbs return again next year. The simple secret is not to cut, prune, or otherwise remove their green leaves because they collect the solar energy that will grow next year's flowers. But don't go hiding the pruners just yet, because we'll be right back with grown potatoes above ground and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. The cicadas are coming. Again! I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll review what you need to know about another giant emergence of the pestiferous periodicals this summer. Plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll teach you how to grow potatoes without digging of any kind, and how to grow potatoes even if you don't have any ground to plant them in. It's amazing! And it'll be coming up right after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls. Every once in a while, we get a call on our recorded line from somebody who has a great question, but they're not available to ask that question during the times that we're taping the show. So every once in a while now, we're going to play the recorded question, and I'm going to try and answer it.
My name is Mary Beth, and I have a question for Mike McGrath. I live in Egg Harbor Township in New Jersey, and we have VF1 and 2 wilt in our container soil and have had success growing the mountain varieties of tomatoes due to their resistance. Short of totally replacing our soil, is there anything we can do to combat the VF1 and 2 wilt so we could again grow some heirlooms? Thanks so much for your time.
Now, it's interesting that Mary mentions the mountain variety of tomatoes. This was a variety that was bred to be resistant to late blight, which is the death trap for tomatoes. And she mentions verticillium wilt, which is a very common disease that occurs when you grow tomatoes in the same spot year after year. Now, typically, verticillium wilt affects tomatoes growing in the ground. I'm surprised that it's affecting container-grown tomatoes unless she made a crucial mistake, and that was partially filling the container with garden soil. You know, when we talk about container mixes, we always talk about compost and professionally graded topsoil and perlite, not your garden dirt. You build raised beds to get away from that junk, you know. So if she has a verticillium wilt in her containers, now we got to think about, well, how big are these containers? If they're raised bed size, that's a whole different story. But if they're big pots, I would suggest she empty those pots out into a wheelbarrow, rinse the inside with vinegar. Don't ever use bleach. There's no need to use bleach. Just rinse it down with some vinegar, then rinse it real well, and fill it up with non-garden soil. Because verticillium is present in soils. It's, I'd say, the atmosphere, but that's the air. It's present underground. It's a naturally occurring organism. So if you start with a soil-free mix, there's no verticillium unless the tomato plants carried it in from the nursery. Now, I know she talks about the mountain variety of tomato, but like I said, that was bred to combat the worst tomato disease, late blight. I wonder if she has tried varieties, and there are quite a few of them, that are verticillium resistant. And these are so easy to identify, verticillium and fusarium, which is a very similar disease that occurs in warmer climes, are such a prevalent problem in farming and gardening that tomatoes that are sold in seeds and in already started in pots will have the letters after their name. They'll have VF. There might be a couple of other letters there. You know, raise the tomatoes as well as you can. Take that contaminated soil and use that somewhere in the garden. But if you don't introduce any garden soil to the containers, there's almost no way that the verticillium can show up, especially if you start your own seeds. If you're worried about it, there's no harm in taking a start that you bought at the garden center and brushing all the soil off the bottom and then just rinsing the roots with cold water and replanting. Tomatoes can be moved around easily. Also, a final thought, a lot of conditions look like verticillium, where the bottom leaves of the plant turn yellow. And the first year, the yellowing progresses slowly up the plant. The year after that, if you plant in the same spot, it moves up faster. And by the third year, the tomato is really suffering. So do a little digging into tomato diseases and make sure you're not accidentally confusing it with something else. Most important, you can't stop rain from wetting the leaves of your tomatoes, but you can stop you from wetting the leaves of your tomatoes. So give them as much sun as possible. Don't wet the leaves. Make sure they have good drainage. And, you know, light a candle to the Blessed Mother. Couldn't hurt, right? All right, as promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we're calling growing potatoes above ground in a Lehigh bin. Bruce in Toronto writes, I'm planning on making a, quote, Lehigh bin for my potatoes this year, but I can find no reference as to how large the gaps that the potato greenery will go through should be between the slats. I want enough room for the potato plants to be able to come out sideways, but I don't want to be losing soil because the gaps are too large. Could you please make a suggestion? Absolutely, Bruce. First, let's explain how a classic Lehigh bin is constructed. You get enough slats of 4 foot long, rot-resistant lumber to make a bin that's 4 feet high and wide, 4 by 4 by 4. But you don't build solid walls. Instead, you stack each piece of lumber so that you have a slat, then an opening the same size as the slat, then another slat, then another opening, until you reach 4 feet high, although there is no harm in growing higher. I called master craftsman Fred Matlack to help me better communicate the look of this structure, and he replied that the design is the same as the classic log cabin corner lap. Way back when, he relates, log cabins were built by layering logs in this same manner. Then the gaps between the legs were packed with wood chips and clay and plastered over, which you will not do. Fred continues, someone with even rudimentary carpentry skills should be able to build a Lehigh bin. I recommend they use 2x4s for the lumber. Just be aware that, quote, 2x4 is an archaic and technically inaccurate term that refers to the initial cut of the lumber, which was indeed 2 inches by 4 inches when it was cut fresh. But the wood then shrank during the drying process, and the result was inconsistent. So lumber mills established a new standard, shaving the dry wood to make it a consistent 1.5 by 3.5. Although everybody still calls them 2x4s. When these, quote, 2x4s are stacked to make the classic Lehigh bin, the openings between the slats will be 3.5 inches, which is just about the width of the 4 fingers on one hand. Cedar is the more expensive choice of wood, but it will last longer. Dirt cheap, untreated pine should last for several seasons. A few more if you don't mind the bottom boards showing some signs of decay. And if you're only using the bin to grow potatoes, you can empty it out after you harvest those potatoes, fold it up flat, and store it inside in the off season for an even longer life. The finishing touch is to drill matching holes on all 4 corners and inserting a metal rod down the entire length of the lumber to hold the bin together. Use a fiberglass rod if rust is an issue. Thank you, Fred. Fred Matlack is an amazingly talented carpenter who built my office furniture using boards from an old barn, built our laundry room cabinets out of old packing crates, and built all the structures for Organic Gardening Magazine's award-winning major exhibits at the Philadelphia Flower Show in the 90s. He is also an excellent singer and can disarm a nuclear device using 3 paper clips and a stick of Juicy Fruit gum. Back to Bruce in Toronto. I don't believe the spacing between the slats will be an issue. Remember, these bins, designed by engineers at Lehigh University, along with the legendary J.I. Rodell, the man who coined the term organic gardening, were originally designed for use as compost bins, and I can personally assure you that they hold their contents well. If a little dirt or compost does spill out the sides, just scoop it up and toss it back on top. Now let's fill that bin. Shovel a mix of screen topsoil, perlite, and compost into the empty bin until it's about a third full. Then place 1 seed potato in each quadrant, north, south, east, and west. Position them close to the outside with the biggest eyes facing outward. Then fill the bin up another third and repeat. When you get about halfway between the top of the batch you are shoveling in and the top of the bin, place a third run of seed potatoes on each quadrant and 1 spud in the center. Be sure to bury this final run under enough soil that the developing potatoes won't be exposed to sunlight. The green leaves that emerge through the slats and top should get as much sun as possible, but the new potatoes should never be exposed to the sun or they'll turn green, a sure sign that toxins have developed. Water the bin deeply and water again anytime you go a week without an inch of rain. Continue to add soil to keep the bin topped off. At the end of the season, just lift that bin straight up and go treasure hunting. If the soil was loose enough, you should get around 5 pounds of potatoes for every seed potato you planted, without any digging. One final word of advice. Don't coin your seed potatoes. Cutting them into pieces is something commercial farmers pretty much have to do to keep their expenses down, but it greatly increases the risk of rot, especially if spring is cool and wet. That sure was an interesting option for potato growing now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure, plus lots of previous questions of the week by following the link for the question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to poach my potatoes if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100. That's 610-694-8100 and follow the prompts to reach You Bet Your Garden. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shores at our new email site, youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Either way, please include your location, and if you're a wonderful person, your phone number as well. You'll find our new phone number, our new Gmail address, a link to the written version of that all-important question of the week, links to our podcast sites, and that website you go to register for my May 10th appearance at the Easton Nurture Nature Center. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Hey, getting pretty crowded up here. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station, WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when a bonk on the head from a falling tree branch erased his memory of being a successful businessman and turned him towards a life of compost. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziproth. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome ninja, Sean. Special thanks to our mulching guest, Bill Strzok. I have two web addresses you can learn more from. SaltHay.com and MidAtlanticPineStraw.com. Remember, there's a dash between Mid and Atlantic. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll continue moving my baby pepper and tomato starts into bigger individual containers in expectation of planting them outdoors, hopefully about a month from now. I'll keep doing that until I see you again.